to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to continue our exploration of the cultures of consciousness. One of the things I often like to do when the topic of death comes up is to just kind of hang with it in conversation, not to get morbid, but not to turn away. And it's remarkable, even among people who are, you know, progressive, forward-looking, spiritual, hard-headed, you know, the kinds of people that you associate being able to really have a real conversation about anything in our world, especially something that there's no avoiding and that in many ways actually constitutes our very existence as human beings, as entities who are aware of their own inevitable demise. It's kind of remarkable how often people sort of turn away from it. There's all these methods we have of kind of eluding the sort of confrontation, because in some sense we can't really confront it. We don't know. It's this void, this black hole at the edge of our existence, and we have so many fears about it and so many issues that come up around it. And, you know, I think it's an extremely important aspect of human maturity, and really just of fascination, of interest, to stay with the question, to go through the morbidity, to go through the fear, to try to maybe find something that has a more nuanced view of this thing, partly in a way as its own kind of journey, its own kind of spirituality. In some spiritual religious traditions, I think of particularly of Buddhism, because in like the traditional presentation of a course of Buddhist meditation, let's say in Tibetan Buddhism, where you're going to go through, you know, countless levels of spiritual practice and invoking deities and transforming, and if you're going to go into the Vajrayana of tantric transformation, et cetera, it all begins with the contemplation of death, of your own body decaying, moving through the visualization of your own body decaying, a stark confrontation and acceptance, and face on face experience of your own death, almost to wake yourself up from this almost inevitable human capacity to recognize abstractly that we're going to die, but not actually to live as if we're going to die or to think about it regularly. I think about death probably a little bit every day, maybe not every day, but most days, sometimes in meditation, sometimes just in the way that the world itself reminds you of this kind of reality, really just kind of sitting with it. And to me, it's been a very liberating process, partly because, it, you know, whether it's my life or other people's lives, it is part of our existence. And when it comes up in reality, it's nice to think that we at least have a little bit of some preparation for that. And so today, I'm very happy on the show. We have Rue Callender, who is a green undertaker. That's probably the best way to describe him, from the UK. And I met him many years ago and always really enjoyed our conversations. And recently, he has been the editor and contributor to the Natural Death Handbook, which is put out by an institute called the Natural Death Center in the UK, that includes not only sort of handy-dandy tips on how to think about some of the practical and logistical issues that surround death, which is another thing that in denying and forgetting and avoiding the reality of our own deaths and the deaths of our loved ones and family in particular, we also tend to overlook all of the logistical aspects. You know, that's one of the absurdities of death, is at the moment of this, you know, from the side of the living, of this greatest confrontation with, you know, the most terrifying aspect of life in some ways. We also have to kind of deal with, like, oh, what are we going to do with the body? And then there's this whole industry that we didn't know anything about, and oh my God, we have to make all these decisions. And so it's kind of a strange process for a lot of people, because they don't really pay attention to it. And so the Natural Death Center, among other things, is also invested in educating people. But along with the sort of handy-dandy tips, some of which don't really apply for people who are not living in the UK, there's a collection of really remarkable essays that sort of attempt to map out a lot of the dimensions, not only of the kind of existential aspect of dying, but some of the ways in which we respond to it culturally. The fact that death is, among other things, a social social event, something that happens in human societies, and that the way that we deal with it and have always dealt with it reflects something about our societies, and that, like everything else these days, the meaning of death, both from a biological and from a cultural perspective, is kind of up for grabs, particularly in a increasingly post-religious world, which is much more true in the UK than it is, let's say, in the United States, in terms of the degree of people who just really have very little, if not any truck, with religion. But then what do you actually do with a burial, where traditionally that's where the priest happens? So people are addressing some of these issues, and I'm really looking forward to our conversation today. But first we'll bring on our co-host here in Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Hi, Maja.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, good. Hey, have you ever been to a cool funeral? Like, I've never been to a cool funeral. They've all been just sort of like kind of what you'd expect.
Well, I can tell you about a pretty magical funeral that I was involved in. It's kind of a sad story, though. You want to hear it?
Yeah.
Well, so a very profound experience I had with death was very recently. I went with my friend through, her baby died, and she was like 7 months pregnant. So she was far enough along that she had to go through the birth. So she actually had to learn that her baby had died, and, you know, 2 days she had to wait until she had to go through the birth, and then the baby was large enough that it had to be cremated. So I, you know, went through this process with her. There's no equipment really that we're given to deal with situations like this. It was just, you know, how do you deal with that? So I was helping her with a lot of stuff, and then we went and did the funeral, and we went to the beach, and we took the baby's ashes and went to the water. And we decided, you know, to send the baby back into the sea. And we went with the ashes and took them and placed them right into a wave that was coming. And as soon as baby went into the water, a seal popped its head up like 2 feet in front of us and just stared at us into our eyeballs, like looked right into our, and it was literally like simultaneous, like baby went into the ocean and the seal head just popped right up.
That's amazing.
Just stared at us. And there was all kinds of other people on the beach, and we just hung out with the seal for like 30 minutes. And then as we went back to our car, the seal followed us the entire way back to the car and just hung out.
That's amazing. Well, I mean, I think part of that, what that refers to, is just the returning the process of you know, dealing with the body in terms of nature, you know,
yeah,
that opening that up. And I think that's one of the reasons that some people are attracted to cremation, at least in the States, is people often scatter the ashes. So it's a way to, like, you know, kind of be in nature. And, you know, increasingly there are cemeteries that, as we'll talk about, you know, really try to bring forward the sort of, you know, natural dimension of it. That story reminded me of one really cool, not quite a funeral, since it wasn't quite an entity, but it's still, I think it's worth telling because it's a very kind of inspiring story, where I had a couple friends of mine who had been trying to have a kid many times, and she had miscarriage after miscarriage, and eventually they did have a child, so it does have a nice story. But one of the miscarriages, processes actually resulted in abortion, because it was a Down's syndrome baby. But they felt really uncomfortable about just like, okay, it's a Down's baby, we're just going to abort it and then be done with it. They were pagan types, and they were like, they wanted to do something. So they had a ritual where they symbolically buried, I can't remember what it was, I think I wasn't present, but they symbolically buried a rock or a stone,
right,
or something like that. But the thing that they did that really blew me away was they had everybody stand in a circle, and in order to acknowledge this, whatever you want to call it, not, is it a being, is it an entity, is it a soul, we don't even know what it is, they walked around slowly with the printout of the DNA that showed the extra chromosome that would indicate a Down's child. But so they just, everybody had to kind of look at this, you know, this scientific object, this like technical, you know, readout that's so, you know, abstract and not embodied in a way, and yet that was sort of the register of this being, this entity. So I thought that was very marvelous. So obviously there's a lot of room for creativity around that, and I think that's partly what we're going to be talking about today. But with no further ado, Rue, thank you so much for joining us on Expanding Mind. Are you there?
Company, how you doing?
Good, good.
It's lovely to be here.
Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from the sunshine capital of the UK, which is Totnes in Devon.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah, it's not. It's been raining for almost a month now. It's appalling. We've sacrificed our summer in favor of a monsoon. People have been swept away in flash floods this afternoon up in the north of England. It's terrible. Are you there?
Yeah, yes. Oh, that sounds like a total disaster.
It's a very typical British summer, to be honest, Eric. It's just getting more extreme as the weather gets weirder and weirder.
Yeah, that's the go. But I think maybe we could start with just a little bit about how did you wind up being an undertaker? I mean, that's even the phrase undertaker is something that we've talked about, I know, before. That's not the kind of thing most people start out like their lives doing unless they come from a family of people in the funeral industry. So how did you...
Absolutely not. I mean, you know, 15 years ago, if you had told me I would be an undertaker, I wouldn't have believed it. And actually, even using the term undertaker is quite controversial. In the UK, most people who do this prefer to call themselves funeral directors, you know, with sort of capital letters. There's a kind of... There's a bit of a professional insecurity about it, really, which I think... So calling ourselves undertakers is trying to return us to the sort of status of enthusiastic amateur, I suppose. I tell you how I became... I saw a guy on the television who started the charity The Natural Death Centre. I just happened to turn it on. I saw him for 3 minutes. He was talking about a different way to approach funerals. He was talking about the environmental aspect, but he was also talking about the social aspect. And it completely blew my mind. I'd been through a lot of bereavement. My father died when I was 7, and my mother died when I was 25, and I didn't deal with either of those very well. So when I saw this guy on the television, it was a total light bulb moment. I stood up and went, that's it, I'm going to be an undertaker. There's very little regulation around it in the UK. There's no training you need to do because you're not actually required by law to use an undertaker. Anybody can go and collect their dead relative from the hospital. They don't need a priest to take the service. They can do all the paperwork themselves. So
there is no
status that says, right, there's no exam you have to pass in the UK. It's very different in the US. I think in the US you're not allowed to do any of this without a licensed funeral, certainly in some states, without a licensed funeral director being involved. So I just started up. I put out a press release. I babbled about it to everybody for about a year. I did some research. I read a lot. I had a picture taken wearing a suit with the Oxford Book of Death tucked under my arm, leaning against a tree. That went in our local paper, and I waited for the phone to ring, and it did, and that's how I started. And I kind of learnt as I went along. Everything that we've really learnt, we've learned from the people who've been generous and brave enough to invite us into their grief, really.
Mm. Well, I think one thing that might help also as we talk further is just to talk a little bit more about how different the contemporary condition of dealing with dead bodies and memorializing them is in the UK, let's say, against the United States. The undertakers is obviously a huge part too. I didn't know that. In the States, you know, the funeral industry has been powerful enough such that it's kind of wormed itself into these processes in a very firm way. I mean, I remember how striking it was to me to find out that in many states, it's mandatory that embalming occurs, even if there's going to be a cremation, where it's completely pointless and arguably always a bit pointless, unless you were, go back
absolutely,
to the 19th century
yeah.
and the Civil War or whatever. But cremation has a very, very different flavor, let's say, in the UK than it does, I think, for a lot of people in the United States, where it's seen as kind of a little bit more groovy. But it's really the industrial kind of mainstream of the funeral there, in at least to judge from some of the essays I read in your book. So tell me a little bit about like what the kind of standard situation is for people in the UK.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. As I understand it, in America, A cremation is something which is, it's quite sort of high end, and I think it's quite popular in California, but not so in other states, where it's here in the UK, it really is the default setting. Over 70% of people are cremated. And the thing is, the way we differ from cremation from you is the actual furnaces are built around the site that you have the service. So that has its plus sides and its minus sides. I think it's very good that you're actually at the place where they are being burnt, but it means you're under a terrible time constraint and a pressure. So most crematoriums give you a half-hour slot. So if you've got half an hour, that's really 20 minutes because, you know, it's 5 minutes to get everyone in and 5 minutes to get out. 20 minutes is barely enough time to settle yourself in your seat. It's certainly not enough time to pull off a decent ceremonial service. It used to be that you'd have the service in a church and then the family would go on to the crematorium afterwards. So the 20 minutes was okay. It was just the, you know, the standard committal. But we really are a post-religious country, so most people go straight to the crematorium, and it's just too short. All you need is for one person to overrun by a couple of minutes, and you know you've got angry the next funeral party knocking on the door behind you. You know, it's a nightmare. It really is a nightmare.
Why is it so fast? Is it because there's so many people to go through, or
yeah,
what is, oh.
Yeah, it is. It's because there's so many people to go through. Most of them are sort of council run. They're, you know, run by the local authorities, so they're under some sort of time constraints. Yeah, it's basically just pressure. There's a constant stream. They have about I think maybe sort of 8 slots a day. They start early and it goes all the way through until 5 o'clock. There's a constant stream of mourners. There's a one-way system. You come in one door, you sort of approach what is a kind of mock-up of a church layout. There's what's known as the catafalque that the coffin sits on. You have the service, that the curtain trundles around. The funeral director ushers you out of the side door, and you try not to get a glimpse of the next party coming in. It's not good.
Wow. So when you started out as an undertaker, how much were you like right up from the get-go going, okay, we got to do something other than this. We have to be able to provide people a different way of doing that. And then what were some of the hurdles and insights that you got, especially early on, about how different a modern funeral could be, both in terms of the logistics and in terms of what, let's call it, the spirituality of it, the element of it that at least transforms or replaces that religious quality that was so typical for people in earlier centuries?
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of my influence was, the position I came from was knowing absolutely what not to do, really. I mean, we still do cremations, but we're trying to open the whole experience up. But My mother, for instance, was a liberal atheist all of her life, but when she died, her service was in the local church with the vicar who, you know, did know her, but it was still a religious service with the traditional funeral directors. I can't really remember much about it. I sleptwalked through it, to be honest. She had a standard coffin, and more importantly, she had the bearers, which are, you know, the sort of the hangover from the professional mourners, really. You know, very in the UK, the people who carry the coffin usually come with the funeral director, and they're retired men wearing kind of fairly shabby suits with a kind of cartoon face of solemnity on them. So very early on, I knew that was not what we wanted to do, really. So, you know, the phrase DIY or DIY culture is really quite applicable here. Firstly, we slow the whole process down. It usually takes about a week, sort of 9 days to have between someone dying and the funeral in this country. We try to slow it down to about 2 weeks. And that allows us time to kind of fully come to a decision which isn't rushed, really. You know, there's something like 90 decisions that have to be made around a death and a funeral, and it's really very easy to feel railroaded into those decisions, and some unscrupulous funeral directors slightly take advantage of that. You know, bereaved people are in a very, very fragile state. You can actually get them to do what you want. You can pressure them into buying a really expensive coffin. You can they basically come to you and go, tell me what to do. You know, what is the etiquette? And the funeral director is the gatekeeper. And if you just kind of go, well, if you start from a completely different place and just go, well, tell me what happened, tell me about this person, then it, organically it just sort of grows, really. But something that happened very early on was the sort of people who are coming to us weren't necessarily, well, they're not necessarily traditional or they're not necessarily religious. So the question of who was going to take the service came up very, very early on. And I almost before I'd dealt with my first actual body, I'd taken a funeral service and realized that this was the way to go. So there's only my wife and I who work in the company. We pick up the phone, we do all the paperwork, we collect the body, we dress the body, we create the ceremony, and we actually take it with the family. So hopefully it creates a really kind of intimate experience. We sort of become temporary best friends, as it were, which is, we don't wear suits. We just try to drop the whole kind of formal armor, which is, I think it sets things off on a really bad foot, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I was thinking about reading through the natural death, the essays that accompany the new natural death handbook, was just this whole, you know, I'm so fascinated by the kind of end of religion and the emergence of spirituality and nobody knows what that means and all these sort of questions. And it, what it really brought home for me was that, in a way, how we confront death, how we confront the funeral event, this moment of memorial that is also a practical performance of what we do with the body, which is this overwhelming question that cannot be avoided in any case, that there's something about that that can dial people into what's best about the sort of spiritual but not religious impulse. In the sense that you have no choice. You have to deal with the body. And when the body is dealt with, you, whether or not you show up to the funeral, have to deal with that void. And if you are going to do anything, then anything you're going to do, obviously, if you love this person, it's got to be cool. It, whether it's humble, whether it's magnificent, whether it's quiet, whether it's loud and boisterous, you want that to be a real event that's as meaningful as a, you know, that has as much resonance as a wedding. But obviously that is a place where all of these things are going to come up, where even people who are very secular, don't think about the afterlife, don't think about God, aren't interested in the New Age, they just do what they do. Even for them, this is a place where what is most meaningful in life, you want it to be part of that ceremony. So you're in a very interesting place, because in a way, the more bare and simple and direct and honest the event is, in a way, that's as spiritual as anything. I mean, it sounds to me like you're right in that zone.
Yeah, that hopefully that's exactly where we are. I think when we first started it, we might have had a tendency to sort of make it all quite busy. You know, there was sort of a lot of singing and lots of different readings, and the temptation to kind of pull down a lot of stuff from other people's culture and kind of mix it all up was quite overwhelming. But as our confidence grew, we've just kind of stripped it back more and more and more. And really, you're right. What honesty is the key to it all, because there's usually somebody who is, you know, an elderly parent who still has a sort of kind of religious feelings or comes from a religious culture, who is nervous when we get involved because they think we're going to make them do all sorts of stuff that they're very uncomfortable with. But actually, we just try and kind of be as direct and truthful as possible. And our ideal funeral is a hole in the ground, and just which the people, the family of the person who's died, carry the coffin to the hole in the ground, and we stand in a circle and we talk about them, and we talk as honestly about them as we possibly can. We really try and avoid that sort of, you know, the tendency to lionize somebody because they've died and to, you know, gloss over all their faults.
Well, and that's really what happens, and that I feel like all the stuff you're doing is such a healing antidote to it, because it's detachment. The thing that people do in funerals and dealing with death is they completely detach, and they're not present, and they're not involved in it. And like with what Eric was saying, having something you can do with it, like, so you don't just like zip into a place and sit down and watch it go in the furnace and then take off. Something you can actually be involved in and participate. People don't want to participate in death or participate with the dead body. And I think that really is the core of what you got. It doesn't have to be anything flashy, but you have to just be involved and participate in the death of this person.
Absolutely. You're so right, Marjorie. It's about stopping people from being an audience and trying to get them back into being a congregation again. So things like, you know, the traditional coffins, and I imagine it's the same in the US, the handles which are on the side are, certainly in the UK, they're just screwed on. They're just for effect. You can't actually bear the weight of the coffin with them. So you need people to lift it up on the shoulders. Now, the coffins we use, which all just happen to be biodegradable, all have handles which are practical. So anybody can carry them. Women, old women, children, you know, depending on the weight, it's entirely possible for them to carry them. They don't have to be the same height. And that physical act, just, it stops you from going up into your head and becoming too detached with it. You're embodying it. If you carry the coffin, and also if you actually lower it into the ground, if that's all you do at the ceremony, that really is enough. But you talked about embalming. That's something we feel very, very strongly about. I mean, it's not quite as prevalent as it is in the US. And you're absolutely right. It's mandatory in some states that you have to be embalmed. We think it's a really kind of weird, it's a very, very violent and intrusive process that goes on. And the chemicals involved are horrendous, if not, you know, for the actual environment, certainly for the people who are doing the embalming. But it's not just that, it's this kind of, you know, somebody's died, and you know that on a deep, instinctive, biological level. But when you see them, when they've been embalmed, they look like they've just got off the plane after the best holiday of their life, and it jars. So we don't do that. We don't prettify, we don't put on makeup, we don't kind of put on those odd, frilly dressing gowns that you wouldn't have seen dead
so
in,
weird.
If you'll forgive me. But we try to encourage the families to come and spend as much time as possible with the body. You know, everyone's really scared of seeing the person they love dead. And part of that is a kind of the sort of horror film thing that you know, you see a dead person, you're waiting for them to open their eyes. And you very, very quickly realize when you're in the presence of someone who's dead, that's not going to happen. And we get people to come back and forth. They might just go in for the first time for, you know, 10 minutes or something and come out again. But if over the period of sort of 5 or 6 days you can get them to come back and back and back, you can kind of synchronize the head and the heart. You know, your head can know something, but your heart can be in a completely different place. And you need to bring them together. And that's just by simply leading them into the presence of the truth, which is, yeah, they've died. They're not coming back. How terrible is that? And then after a bit, you get to the point of going, right, we now need to deal with the practicalities. So let's either dig a hole or light a fire or do whatever needs to be done. But you can't rush that bit. You just have to kind of ease people into it.
Well, this is just a wonderful, wonderful conversation. I find it extremely inspiring on a lot of levels. But we're going to take a break right now. So we'll be right back. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking with Rue Callender, a green undertaker from the UK, and we'll be right back.
Rue Callender about death and funerals and undertaking and all of that good stuff. And Rue, I was wondering, we've talked a lot about kind of how weird it is how people treat a lot of this stuff in the forms of detachment, and also how you were mentioning at the beginning just how it's this weird mechanization of the process of going through death, where it's like a drive-through or a fast food experience where you just kind of go in and do it and get out. And I mean, that kind of approach to dealing with biological things of our body extends to other places too, like with birth. When you give birth, so many people, you know, if you don't take the care or have the money. I mean, all these women, they just get pregnant and then they have to go to the hospital. They don't even know anybody and the baby's just kind of taken out and then it's put in the thing with all the other babies and it's treated very much like a factory. So I was wondering if you had any insights as to how has this death factory method of approaching it occurred? Like, how do you think this developed in our society?
Well, you know, I think the word that you both used earlier on was the funeral industry. And, you know, obviously there is a point where when a business generates enough money, it clearly is an industry. But once you start calling something an industry, it becomes industrialized. And that is what has become to death. That and the kind of, you know, over-medicalization as well. The parallels between the natural birth movement and the natural death movement are absolutely direct. But, you know, death is such an unknown and such a kind of fearful, understandably fearful thing that I think it's kind of in human nature to try and put as many things in between us and it. And, you know, the modern cremators are these extraordinary high-tech furnaces when you just kind of go, actually, you know, it's just a fire. But somehow we've created this environment where you don't see it and you don't, you know, you can really kind of pretend it's not going on. And it's a sort of combination of business forces as well. You know, in the States, the funeral industry is much more rapacious, but actually over here in the UK, just a couple of days ago, there was something which happens sort of every 15 years or so when a TV company goes in with undercover cameras and highlights some of the sort of things that are going on behind the scenes, as it were. And they always hoped to find a lot of really disrespectful body stuff, and they didn't this time. But what they did find was a real culture of kind of just going, you know, don't tell people that they don't have to have them embalmed. They do this thing where they go, okay, well, if they're going to be coming into the chapel of rest, then they need to be embalmed. And that's just not true. And it's, you know, once something becomes a kind of lumbering capitalist beast, then it gets a bit out of control. But I really do think that technology in this instance has just become something that we've just desperately placed in between us and death.
As a way to kind of remove ourselves from it.
Yeah, entirely understandably. You know, it really is a fearful thing. I mean, to echo what Eric was saying, I've thought, my father died when I was 7, and I think I've probably thought of my own death every day since then. I think of it constantly, and I'm a little horrified to discover I'm not Buddha, and I'm far from it. You know, I probably have a kind of higher anxiety level about death than most people. So it's not something, it's really, really difficult to wrap your head around, even when you're around it constantly. So it's understandable that this whole world has sprung up to kind of go, okay, you know, as Philip Larkin said in his poem Obeyed, when he was talking about religion, he said, religion used to try that vast moth-eaten musical brocade created to pretend we never die. And, you know, if sort of traditional Christian religion is kind of doing a part of that, then the traditional funeral industry, which has gone hand in hand with it, is just aiding and abetting. So really, we're kind of trying to come in as low tech as possible. I mean, our equipment is literally just a stretcher. It's just my wife and I in a stretcher. So things like if the practicalities, you know, talking about carrying the coffin, that's a sort of, we almost made a virtue out of necessity, as it were. But we kind of go, well, look, we can between us just about carry this coffin, but when it actually comes down to it, we need your help. So as you're the family, why don't you come and join in? And it's that kind of simple. And once you've started this process of letting people in, then it blossoms. And it's an extraordinary privilege to be around people at this time. It really is. It's I wouldn't think of doing anything else now, because it just gives you such a wonderful insight into human nature. And
have you ever seen anything kind of like extraordinary happen at any of the funerals, like something you couldn't explain or something that just really kind of blew you away?
Oh, we're blown away all the time. There's never been anything that, you know, there's never been anything that I could actually go, okay, that's really quite spooky. I mean, there's things like that. Your seal story was absolutely beautiful, and there's little things like that happen all the time. And bereaved people can kind of, you know, suddenly the world is filled with meaning. Rainbows are a very significant thing for people who've just lost a family member. But you know, I've seen some incredible moving things where we did a funeral for a woman who had died. She'd had MS for about 15, 20 years. And she had two children. Her son was 15 and her daughter was 21. And she thought just before she gave birth to her daughter, she thought she wasn't going to make it. The doctor said there was, you know, really quite a chance that she would die during the childbirth. So she had written a letter to her husband talking about, you know, if I die during this is, you know, how much she loved him. And he didn't actually find that letter. He didn't know it was in existence until after she died.
So good.
And he didn't actually find it until about sort of, you know, 5-6 days into the process. So to suddenly find this letter was, you know, you go, that it was, there was a very much made me think of Ray Bradbury. There was a sort of time traveling element to it, which was just breathtaking. And it kind of broke him and lifted him up at the same time. It was this incredible voice from the past and beyond the grave telling him that it was going to be all right, and talking about, you know, not even knowing about these glorious 21 years that she would have with this child and another child which would be born later. So moments like that just, you know, absolutely make your heart sing. They really do. Mm. But people, ordinary people, are filled with, you know, have wells of courage and goodness which rise up in these circumstances. It's just a privilege to kind of be anywhere near them, really.
Well, it sounds to me, I mean, one of the things that's sitting in the back of my head, and that was also stirred up again by reading some of the essays, is this whole question about what role you have as either, let's say, from the more practical side, the undertaker, but also from a more, you know, ritual side, the kind of celebrant or the person who kind of stands in for what the priest or the preacher used to do. You know, and I'm really thinking about that role. I mean, I've done a small number of weddings myself and being the celebrant for them, and that was, you know, it's an interesting challenge for me, partly because it's one of those moments when people want something that is like, you know, that has elements of religion but is not religious. And then part of the challenge is to figure out, given these people and this situation and this natural setting, what can we do? You know, it's always a little different to weave all this stuff together into something that has ritual meaning for essentially post-religious people. And, you know, the question of what you do in a funeral is obviously, you know, it's much heavier. It's more complicated. But in some ways it almost sounds like it's almost more simple, because you have found a way, at least in some of the funerals you've done, to almost let the necessities of the moment be the things that are setting up or creating the ritual settings, rather than, as you said before, adding a lot of, you know, busyness or overlaying it with, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. But just personally, how have you come to see your role in that more spiritual or ritual post-religious sense as you deal with people?
Well, you're right, because a lot of the doing has become the meaning. But I also do feel very strongly that, you know, it's all about what you say, and it's risky what I do, because I don't show the families the script beforehand, because unless they really ask me, because I feel what I'm saying is I want them to hear it here. And I try to be really honest, and I try to hear what they're, you know, active listening, that what they're really saying. And it can stray into paternalism as well, because quite often you can kind of, you know, what they think they want is not necessarily what I think they need. So I kind of live in fear of someone going, that's an outrageous liberty that you've taken in what you said there, particularly when we do a lot of funerals for tragic deaths. We do a lot of funerals for people who've killed themselves, and young, you know, drug misadventures, or kids who just got into the wrong car and never came home. And when you're trying to strip it back and be honest and honor their life by telling it as it really is, it's a very, very scary area that you operate in, where you just terrified that someone's going to go, how dare you? But
have you ever had an experience where someone had a, you know, like, terrible reaction to your service?
No, not yet. Not yet. I do live in fear for it, and I, you know, there's times when I go, okay, you know, I shouldn't be, I just, I don't actually finish writing the script usually until sort of 5:30 of the morning of the service. I've done the bulk of it days before, but you know, it might just be fine-tuning it, and someone might have said something the day before the funeral which suddenly sheds a bit of light on it, and you go, okay, that's what's really going on there. But funnily enough, Eric, I took my first wedding ceremony about 3 weeks ago, and people had asked us to do them before, and we'd always gone no, because actually, in the way that I was saying that death and this situation brings up the best in people, weddings can often bring out the worst in people. And they go on for a lot longer. They go on for a year, and, you know, the idea of the bridezilla is very much kind of embedded in everyone's consciousness now. But I did agree to do this wedding because I buried the girl who's getting married. I buried her uncle. And I wanted to kind of see if I could do it, really. So I found it way more scarier than doing a funeral. That might have just been because it was a little bit out of my comfort zone. But I found that I was doing pretty much the same thing. And what I tried to kind of do was, without kind of referencing an afterlife too much, was just sort of kind of bring in the concept of the ancestors and go, you know, I welcomed everybody in the room, and I welcomed the bride and groom, but then I kind of went, and also, you know, standing around us, there are your family stretching back into time, and this is all their story as well. And you know, at the end of it, I was like, wow, it's a funeral. It's just a sort of funeral in reverse. It's a funeral with a with a happy ending. The kind of spiritual nub of it was very, very much the same.
Well, and it's really true, because weddings certainly have been industrialized for sure.
Yeah.
So hardcore, just as much as birth and death. And really, you know, I've done weddings and funerals before too, and one of the things I've noticed, and it sounds like what you're saying with the thing that you provide, and what I think Eric probably provided too, is I hate this word because it's become so new agey, but you're literally holding the space for people, where you're like, you're making it possible to have an arena where people can open and participate.
Absolutely.
And if they're, you can't feel comfortable opening if you're literally just kind of like going in and out or zipping out, or you're concentrating on money. You can't get into the experience of it, get into your body, get into the sense of it, the visceral nature of any of those kinds of experiences, unless someone like you is there to kind of make it okay for that to happen.
You're absolutely right. It is. It's a strange new age phrase, holding the space, but it totally describes what you are doing. And it's such a kind of frail and nebulous thing that, you know, you can't even really define it, how someone can hold a space and someone else can do exactly the same thing, but they're clearly not holding it. It's really weird. And I don't know what gives you the kind of authority, but some people have got it. Oh, I hope I've got it. And I'm sure you've got it, Marcia. And I know Eric's got it. But I've also, you know, part of the reason we took all of the ceremonies in-house was I've seen people who haven't got it. And it's a terrible thing to do. You know, if you ruin a big ceremony in someone's life, if they've chosen to do something which isn't the sort of traditional and the norm, it's huge. You know, you can really screw up people's lives.
One word you mentioned when talking about the wedding, which I might actually just steal, it's a good idea, is ancestors. And there's a couple of essays, you know, kind of the weirder essays in your collection, have to do with the ancestors and the sense of how, in a naturalist frame of mind, meaning like a world where all we really have is nature and the cosmos, there's we don't know about God, we don't know about the afterlife, maybe, you know, whatever, these stories have some resonance to us because our grandmother told them to us or something, but we're not really living in that world, in this, what I'm saying here, but we're living in a natural world. But the natural world has its own mysteries, its own spirits, its own animism, and there's an essay in there about the relationship between animism and the ancestors. So I'm wondering for you how the idea of the ancestors, the presence of the ancestors, what does that mean? How has that come to, in a way, kind of create a bridge between a naturalistic world where we die and are put in the earth forever, and a world of kind of animate meanings that, you know, again, have a religious character without actually being religious in a traditional sense?
Yeah, well, I think that the concept of the ancestors is really, really crucial to this, and it's very easy to misconstrue it. And you know, I personally, I don't know, I'm really not sure about an afterlife. I hope, I really do hope, and I have a feeling that you can kind of create your own reality. But the idea of the ancestors is not about a kind of another world. It's about placing yourself, it's about knowing where you are and where you're coming from. I'm actually going to be doing a ritual. We're going to be inaugurating some patrons for the Natural Death Center, which is something that the charity hasn't had before. And three of the patrons are going to be living, but two of them are going to be dead. And this is a first in the UK to have sort of patrons that, you know, can't give their permission, as it were. But the point we're trying to make is that we are mortal, but our legacy and our ideas are totally immortal, and the baton can be passed out of the darkness from anyone. And once you have that kind of sense that the past is as relevant as the future and as relevant as the present, and you know that you are part of a chain that drifts back into time and shoots out into the future, whether it's genetic or not, you know, the biggest influences in my life have not necessarily been genetic. They've just been sort of, you know, a couple of significant people in my life I would consider my ancestors. So it's about trying to sort of rekindle this idea. It's a sort of very nascent spirituality, which I think could be really useful for people who are kind of looking around for, you know, they want some sort of a spiritual practice, but they don't want to go back to the old idea of going that there is another life, because that's not really helpful when you're around death. You know, going they're not here, that's the significant thing, not where they are, but where they're not, which is they're not here, and that's what hurts. But getting into sort of ancestor, you know, I use the word veneration cautiously, but getting into that idea of ancestor awareness is a really good way of lessening your kind of ego in, you know, the way you impact on the entire world, and going, actually, you know, I'm not the most important thing, I'm not the first, and I won't be the last.
Well, and it also does another very important thing, which, like you said, the thing that hurts is that they're not there. But when you bring up the awareness of ancestors, if it's someone in your family that has passed, they literally are still there within your own corporeal body, like
absolutely,
in a sense of in your blood and in your bones. So by bringing that up, that's how you integrate that loss, by understanding that the presence of the person who is gone is literally within your body.
Yeah, and that's something else that we really miss in our society. You know, it's funny, on the one hand, you know, increasingly because of science, because of whatever, postmodern theory or whatever, there's an idea that, you know, we're not single subjects, we're not pure individuals, we're made up of all sorts of different forces and language and our inheritance, da da da. And people can think about that way in a more abstract sense, but it's amazing how much the bodily, almost bodily awareness of ancestors tells us the same thing. When I realize that, like, as I get older, my body resembles my father more and more, and in fact, the more I look at it, the more I realize that certain aspects of my personality resemble not just my father, but his father and his father, people who I didn't even know, who are in me in some way, that was whether it was how they behaved or it's actually in the DNA or somewhere in between, which is probably the reality. Those things are in us, and they're also... There's something about the presence of the past that I think is incredibly healing, particularly now when we're hurtling into the future at such terrifying velocity, and it looks like there's a lot of broken transmissions, you know, especially with younger generations, where just because of the nature that they're living in, the world that they're living in, it's harder and harder to feel that sense of any kind of continuous transmission from the past. And one way to get people into that framework of the presence of the past, you know, and it can go too far, but is also through nature, through spots. Like this place where we're coming and looking out over this overlook, it hasn't changed that much in hundreds and hundreds of years. As long as there were people here, they came up here, they had this experience, they had the sense of what it means to have sunlight, you know, dappled light on the grass. And these are very ancient experiences, and I'm wondering, we haven't really talked too much about the nature part of natural death,
how much you also see what you're doing, whether it's in terms of how it relates to the outside, how it relates to the physical processes of growth and decay, the way that nature and bringing something like nature, because it's a complicated, what is nature, but bringing that forward in some way is what you're also doing.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a kind of very obvious connection with natural burial. A pure natural burial is the graveyards resemble fields or woods. They are fields or woods, and you bury somebody and you plant a tree on top of them, and it's almost quite clumsy, but people really kind of get some sort of comfort from that. The natural aspect of not embalming the body, you bury the person in a shallow grave, as shallow as you dare, really, you know, about 3 foot deep, and their physical nutrients are returned to the soil, and you can very easily see the kind of cycle of recreation there. But I think these ideas of connection to the ancestors are really kind of what it's about. There's a great comfort to be found here, which isn't misleading, you know. It's a genuine... There's nothing bogus about thinking about the ancestors and how that makes you feel in your place, that you're not referencing something that might be happening. You're not kind of going, they're actually looking down on me, even if that can become part of it. You're just kind of fixing yourself in your moment in time and realizing that moment will be gone. And that you will be, you know, we are born the ancestors. We don't become them when we die. We're all absent friends in waiting. And to just kind of, to realize that for a minute and go, it's okay, is a source of profound comfort for me anyway.
Well, and it's important for the person that died too. Like actually in China, they have this concept of turning a ghost into an ancestor, right? And they kind of believe that this person that has passed, your family member, becomes a ghost until you honor them, and the family actually has the responsibility of making them into an ancestor to venerate and lift them up instead of them remaining in this ghostly existence. So that's another way that by doing that you kind of participate and are involved in your ancestors' kind of karma.
Yeah, that's I really like that on one level, but then you know there's a kind of element of coercion there which makes you wow, that's a little bit scary.
Tiny.
But I imagine it would certainly work if you go, I've got to turn my father into an ancestor, otherwise he kind of roams the earth in ghostly form. Then
right. You've
got to do your thing, and that's good. But Eric, you were talking about the kind of disconnection that the young feel, and I think you're right. Ancestors probably are more about things like the riots than they are about an afterlife. They really can root you, but it might just be that these ideas are things that you just can't wrap your head around when you're 20. You know, I'm 42 now, so I kind of feel, and I've been around death a lot, so you know, I'm a bit unusual in that sense. But you know, most people don't think about death, don't think about their ancestors. People are living longer and longer. My father-in-law, he's just turned 80. His mother only died about sort of 7 years ago. You know, this is going to be the norm more and more as we kind of almost like galaxies stretching further and further away from us. It's going to become easier to not think about it and to kind of forget the past and not focus on our death. It's a downside to our good health and living longer.
Absolutely. Well, Rue, thank you so much for being on Expanding Mind.
Oh, what a thrill, Eric. I've absolutely loved it.
All right, and folks can find out more on thegreenfuneralcompany.co.uk. There's some really interesting writings by Rue and...
Actually, Eric, no, that's my website. It's best to go to the Natural Death Center website. That's where they can get the book.
Yeah, I was going to do that one next. So naturaldeath.org.uk.
Yeah.
All right, from Maja and me to all you out there, keep your minds open. We'll be right back.